valuations for entrepreneurs are robust right now in all facets of digital health. And if I'm an entrepreneur, that's a terrific time to be raising capital. All cycles cycle. And so we will have a down period. I don't know when that down period is coming. I don't know what's going to cause it. And I don't know how calamitous it's going to be, but it's definitely going to happen.
Bijan Salahizadeh's journey has taken him from D.C. to Iran, Princeton, New York, Silicon Valley, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and now back to Washington, where he runs a healthcare-focused VC. He's one of healthcare's most insightful voices, and we're delighted he's able to join us on the show today.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health. I'm Lisa Soonan.
And I'm David Shaywitz.
We've been talking about the five biggest fat busters for five body types in just 5 days. And now I've got the number one miracle in a bottle to burn your fat. It's raspberry ketone. Ketone is something that I've heard about in the periphery. I never understood how powerful it could be until I started doing research for this. I've seen four.
All right, Bijan. You've said that this guy, Dr. Oz, was one of your most important role models of your career. Was it the raspberry ketones? Help us understand.
It was actually the acai berry. No, but seriously, thanks for having me on, guys. I worked with Dr. Oz as a medical student, and he was one of my real early mentors. He was an entrepreneurial surgeon at Columbia, where I went to medical school, and really one of the two physicians at Columbia that introduced me to the idea that, you know, getting an MD degree, you know, treating patients is just one part of what you can do with an MD degree. And Dr. Oz was involved in all sorts of clinical trials, new device invention, and I slowly got pulled into some of the new cutting-edge technology and venture-backed things that he was working on while I was there. And it opened my eyes to a whole new world of what would be possible to do with an MD degree. And I became a dropout eventually, as they say. I actually finished my medical degree, but went into the entrepreneurial world. Largely, I would attribute to the fact that Mehmet, Dr. Oz, opened my eyes.
You know, he was one of the very first due diligence calls I did when I did my first medical device deal. It was a cardiac surgery deal. And I got to call him. It was a little before he was real famous, you know, and he was still kind of a doctor and not a raspberry ketone guy. And I just remember thinking he was such a nice man. He was so accessible.
Well, apparently a lot of people agree.
He is accessible and a nice man. Exactly. Exactly.
You know, there's a history of a lot of the innovation. Now it seems like many more people are doing it. We can talk about that. But I really feel like cardiac surgeons and surgeons in general, maybe because they're sort of already, you know, so actively doing things, we're really among some of the earliest people in medicine to really get into innovation. When you think about some of the earlier, or to get to become entrepreneurial, was that your sense as well? Was that your experience at Columbia?
It was, and I wanted to become a cardiac surgeon from the first day I went to medical school. That was what I wanted. I wanted to hang out with those guys. I wanted to become one of them. And part of why I wanted to become one of them was because they worked with their hands, and they were always thinking about ways to do things differently and more efficiently, which I was really drawn to. It was one of the reasons I wanted to become a doctor. And it turns out that for the exact reason you identified, a lot of cardiac surgeons became some of the early device innovators and entrepreneurial innovators.
Folks Toby like Cosgrove.
Cosgrove, Michael DeBakey. I mean, a lot of folks who are sort of legendary physicians and also legendary, I'd say, entrepreneurial physicians. And that was that's the world I really sort of started to gravitate to the further I got into medical school. And then I realized that I could go even a step further from that and probably not have to be in the operating room and at least from my perspective, be even more entrepreneurial than being confined by the four walls of a hospital.
I mean, what's interesting is when the top, when you made their decision to, in a sense, not continue on a medical path, that was long before it was trendy. I mean, now there are articles coming out relatively frequently that talk about how it's sort of almost like at least in some quarters, a relatively common or less infrequent option. But at that time, there couldn't have been a lot of people. What kind of reaction did you get when you let it be known that you were going to pursue what at the time was a very unusual course?
Were your parents super psyched about having paid for medical school?
Yeah, they were really excited about that. In fact, my mom still really doesn't understand what I do, and it's been 16, 17 years since I graduated medical school. she probably doesn't really know. Look, it was early. I sort of think about it as a few eras of people having decided to make this career transition after finishing their medical degree. Ross Jaffe at Versant was in that first era in the early 90s.
Right.
I came in the mid to late 90s and did it, and I got a lot of strange looks. I remember the dean of the medical school pulled me into her office – when I decided I wasn't going to enter the residency match and said, you understand you're making a huge mistake, right? We'll be here for you when you change your mind, but you understand you're making a huge mistake. Because I told her I was about to pack up my things and move to Silicon Valley and work for a 12-person startup that had just raised a Series A. And none of those words made any sense to her. It didn't mean anything.
But now you're contact. But now you're on good terms, I imagine, with their development office, right?
they do call and write as if they're old friends.
I do think it's really interesting to hear you guys talk about how innovative cardiac surgeons tend to be, because my recollection of selling to that field through the portfolio company that I had at the time was that these were the least likely physicians to change practice. You know, they were not like cardiologists who would pick up a pen and stick it in you to figure out if it worked, but that they were very conservative in adopting new things. And while there were individuals, like you mentioned, who were super creative, that by and large, it was a very old school, dying out profession in some ways. Do you think that's true, Bijan, or do you see a lot of variation among physicians and types and how they pick up new technology?
Yeah, there's a lot of variation even amongst cardiac surgeons. Here's what I will say. I think part of what you're saying is absolutely right, in the sense that cardiac surgeons essentially felt like they were blindsided by the coronary stent. And so, they were blindsided by a technological wave that basically took away the bread and butter of their income, the bread and butter coronary artery patient that they sort of made their living on and became the gods of the hospital on over the 70s and 80s. And so they've completely missed that wave. But on the other hand, many cardiac surgeons were very MacGyver-esque in how they approached the surgery itself. And it's that MacGyver-esqueness. You know, I grew up as a kid who programmed computers when I was eight or nine years old. I took everything apart in the house and put it back together. Anything that was electronic, I took apart and put back together. And, I probably should have been an engineer, not a molecular biologist.
Your mom's been pissed off for a really, really long time.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Since your mom.
Exactly.
Wow. That's super cool. I mean, is that still possible, that MacGyver approach to medicine?
It's funny. I listened to you guys spoke to Bob Kocher, who's one of my good friends, and I think, part of what we're all trying to do is dial out the variation in medicine. I think MacGyver-esque situations in the hospital, whether it's the operating room or the clinical floors, take place when you don't have standards and you sort of have to wing it in difficult situations. And that's the judgment thing that we sort of all say, the judgment of a physician or the judgment of a surgeon. I don't think we're ever going to get rid of that judgment, despite what some others have said, and the need for that judgment. But I do think dialing out variation is pretty darn important. And I think those two ideas are somewhat opposed to each other, the MacGyver and the sort of robot automaton who does the same thing every time. Neither one is the best in every situation, and
that's
there's probably elements of both that you want in the physician treating you.
And isn't the challenge is to figure out when you're in sort of a usual versus an unusual situation, one of those things where sometimes you want the person who's just going to do it right and predictably, and sometimes you want someone who can innovate and think on their feet, but you just have to make sure that the right person is applying it to the right situation, and it's so hard to determine that, to de-average it prospectively.
Exactly.
Do you think it means the end of innovation for medical technology, though? I mean, is that if you can't MacGyver, you can't invent something new?
Oh, Lisa, I think there's a lot of other things that maybe not the end, but have portended the diminishing, yield of medical technology innovation, as at least as done by surgeons, including physician payment sunshine, including the way we are paying for medical technology increasingly, including the consolidation amongst the large med tech companies. But I think the physician, inventor, entrepreneur, look, they're still out there. They're still inventing. The ability for them to get funded these days by venture capitalists has dried up, and that's probably been as correlated to the reduction in quote, innovation being funded as anything else. And part of that was good. It was a response to an overreaction of overfunding of surgeon and physician-founded medical device ideas. But part of it, I think, is going to be swing back around and be really bad for the system.
So just so we're clear for our audience, what you're talking about, as I understand it, I imagine, is sort of more the med device space, which has just been brutalized in the last decade, right?
I am, but look, in some ways, David, it's all coming together. What was a dumb device is becoming a smart device. What was sensorless is becoming sensored. And I think the really hard challenges, the really hard things that Lisa and I and others were investing in, 10 or 15 years ago, they're probably not being invested in these days. You can call them medical devices. You can call them digital health. I sort of don't care what you call them. But the ones that require a complicated clinical trial and a complicated approval pathway, I think those are the ones, especially when physicians are founding, those are the ones that are increasingly hard to get funded because of sort of the overall landscape and ecosystem, as opposed to biotech, as opposed to healthcare IT that sort of don't have a medical device element to them.
Yeah, do you think it'll ever come back? It's so interesting. I mean, when I started in venture around the same time as you, in the late 90s, mid-90s, the you know, MedTech was taking a bulk of the investment capital, really a large proportion of it. And now it's taking, you know, a minimal amount. But at that time, back in the 90s, health IT was so, you know, so yesterday, nobody was investing in that. Now, of course, that's where a lot of the money is going. Biotech's, you know, held its own along the way for the most part. But do you think we'll ever cycle back?
I don't, you know, I never say never. I remember having coffee with someone in 2009, 2010, and we were all lamenting that the biotech venture capital was dead and everyone was going to go have to look for new jobs.
Exactly.
And here we are 120 venture-backed biotech IPOs later. And, you know, two guys and a dog and a molecule, idea for a molecule or a pathway can get funded and straight to an IPO within 6 months. So never say never, but I think MedTech is always behind biotech in terms of its resiliency. And there's other systemic things in MedTech. So I think it's going to take a long time and for it to get back to where it was.
So you were part of one of the first, of a relatively early healthcare IT startup, weren't you? Could you tell us about that experience?
Yeah, so I left Manhattan. I left, finished medical school and master's in public policy, health policy, and moved to Silicon Valley and worked for a 10 or 12 person startup founded by a famous Bay Area TV physician. You notice a pattern. I like the TV doctors. So, from Dr. Oz to Dr. Dina Dell.
You're a hanger-on.
It's only because you're so telegenic, you should.
Yeah, exactly. And I have a voice. I have a face for radio, as they say. But I worked for Dr. Adele, and he founded a company called Health Central, and it was a health information portal. And back then, you could raise money doing that. And we raised a couple rounds of capital, and 60 days after the Series B, the company was public. And I was 26 years old. I was a Section 16 officer of a public company, and I had no idea what I was doing, running business development for a new public company. And it was an incredible thrill ride. I loved every minute of being in a startup. I love the people, I love the environment, and it was sort of the culmination of what I thought a startup might be. Now, ultimately, that company essentially failed. It was sort of acquired through a series of acquisitions by other people, and there were layoffs and sort of bad things happened. But boy, did I get I got a sort of a mini MBA there in 18 or 24 months, and then I moved on to a big company because, you know, the Bay Area was reeling at that point. But I scratched that itch. And 10 years later, I said, I need to do that again.
So here's an interesting thing. So you were at this company, you went to the larger company, Medtronic, I believe, for a couple of years, the marketing role. And then you went and got sort of a real MBA versus an MBA experience. How did those experiences contrast both when you were doing the MBA? You know, there's always a lot of questions. And actually, one of the most common questions that I get from I would say medical student or, you know, physician colleagues is, should I, or even for other people, should I get an MBA? Should I do consulting instead? Because if you have an MD or PhD, you can go for sort of an advanced degree option where at these consulting companies is actually what I did. What do you think you got from your MBA that you might not have gotten from these other real world experiences?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. For me, I was at a decision point. I was either going to go back and finally do that residency, or I was going to have a career in business of some sort. And I get that question a lot. I don't think there's a right answer. My guidepost was that if I ever wanted to end up on the investment side of healthcare, the one commonality I saw with a lot of investors, although not every investor, certainly many terrific investors have never got an MBA, but
thank
the one
very much,
commonality
Michelle,
I saw was
that.
Yes, was that many had had their sort of the many had that like degree stamping thing that we sort of joke about, and they paid for that. I mean, there's a serious cost, but so I sort of went for that and was lucky enough to get into a good business school and had a terrific experience. I also think what I got out of it, and I think what a lot of physicians often get out of it, is I sort of found my voice a little bit. I think when you come out of medical school and a medical training, I think the default of how we're trained in medical school and how we train our trainees is sort of a regimented, you only speak when spoken to, especially during your training period. You know, there's a totem pole and you sort of rise one click at a time every July up that totem pole in medical school and residency. You know, in business, you speak your mind. You can challenge someone in the room who's more senior than you. And a lot of business schools sort of teach you how to make decisions and speak your mind in the face of uncertain information. And I didn't know I was going to get that going in, but I sure got that in spades, especially in the program I did.
Can you give an example of a time when you did that? You know, a time where you sort of stepped out with your voice for the first time and challenged your superiors on the business side?
Oh yeah, I mean it happened on a on a weekly basis. But I say two things that stick out. I worked for a large venture capital firm coming right out of business school, and there were senior partners who'd been doing the business for years and years and years. I was a young buck, just coming out of business school, and there was a particular consumer healthcare investment that one of the tech partners brought in and wanted to make. And as a, first year associate, in the main partner meeting, I spoke up and said, I think this is a crazy idea. Consumers aren't going to pay for this. Remember, this is 2003. Consumers aren't going to pay for this. We weren't where we were today. And I really challenged someone who'd been an investor for 20 years. And I felt comfortable doing that. Doing that in a hospital, challenging a senior physician or surgeon, you get reamed out afterwards. Doing that in an investment world, that's exactly what they want. In fact, I remember my mentor at Highland Capital, where I was, Bob Higgins, and one of my great friends for life, said, I want you to be a 1 or a 10 on every deal. I want you to say you love it or hate it and justify why. I don't want you to say, how'd you feel about that? Well, that was a 5 out of 10. That was okay. I don't want 5 out of 10s. I want 1s or 10s.
So there's a fine line. It's a fine line between having those definitive opinions and then having a certain boorishness, right, where you sort of have these business people where they sort of act, excessively definitive, and as we've seen in some degree in our recent political process, and have people who have just sort of exaggerated opinions just for the sake of it. I mean, sometimes my sense is that some of the people who are acting like that seem not to exude the sort of nuance that you'd like to have for some of the subtleties of life.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more, David. I mean, I think it's good to be definitive in certain situations, and I think it's even more important to be self-aware and know when you can be definitive and know when you're creeping into being a bore instead of just being an opinionated person. And I think unfortunately or fortunately, the venture capital and private equity worlds are tend to be populated by people who go on to one side of that equation, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's not a place for charm school graduates. Are you do you find yourself today now, many years into venture capital world, are you always still a 1 or a 10? I mean, is it easy to be there? Or, and one of the things I found was it's also so easy to get cynical. It's so easy for everything to look like a 1 and explain to yourself why it can't work. How do you navigate that?
It's funny. My first 3 or 4 years in venture, the story I told you aside, I loved everything. Everything was a new opportunity. I loved it.
Yeah.
Then my next 4 or 5 years, I hated everything was going to fail because I'd probably been on enough boards, had invested in enough things I thought were going to always be winners and seen that it's not always a winner, if you know what I mean. So then I hated everything and I missed a bunch of stuff that I shouldn't have missed, right? I just didn't invest in it. My wall of shame, as Bessemer calls it. And now I think I have the benefit of both of those. I'm a little more balanced in how I approach things. But it's easy to swing guardrail to guardrail. And the legendary Brooke Byers once told me, I was on a board with him. He said, "Never become a cynic. Never become a cynic." It's like when you become a cynic, you sort of it's like the last nail in the coffin of your career as a venture capitalist. And so it's good advice from my perspective. But I think you have to go through those cycles to get there.
What's the great deal you missed? What was the one you still smack your forehead over?
Oh, I mean, there's so many, Lisa, but I can name two, at least in medical devices. We had a clean shot at investing in CoreValve at a $12 million valuation for the Series B. Maybe it was $16 million valuation. And we blew it. And we just blew it. I blew it. I overthought what it was going to be like to take the aortic valve therapy and do something else. I'm giving you med tech examples, but there's plenty of healthcare IT examples. There's plenty of pharma examples. I'm one of those guys who's invested in every, you name a space in health, a sector of healthcare, and I've probably invested in it. And so certainly missed. And that was a $1 billion outcome. And probably one of the most successful therapy areas ever. And so you can overthink things. You can overthink management teams, and there's something about not presenting a 100-page diligence pack. You sort of you get bogged down in the weeds and sometimes lose the 40,000-foot view, which is what it takes to be a good investor sometimes.
Have you ever invested in one where you took a total flyer, where the diligence didn't pan out and you did it anyway?
I'm not a flyer kind of guy, which is probably why I'm doing private equity instead of venture capital these days in my new firm. I'm a real careful guy. Like I speed within like 10 miles of the speed limit when I drive. Like I don't speed plus 25 miles. But look, I mean, some people do that and have this gut thing that I envied. I always wanted that gut thing where I meet someone for 20 minutes and I'm like, this is going to work. Sometimes I think, you know, is that overrated? You know, when you look at the odds of success in the venture business and 55 to 60% of things fail to return 1x capital, as Bruce Booth and I wrote in our paper a few years ago, you know, it's just, I don't know if that gut thing's real or if we attribute success to things that happen to be gut decisions at the time they were made.
I mean, that's the thing I always find so interesting. I don't know how you don't go crazy in your business where, you know, trying to distinguish between the role of luck and skill and the, you know, how you sort of can always sort of tack a narrative onto something afterwards. But at the end of the day, really, you know, it's great when things work out. And then there's also, you know, the firms that do really well, they're sort of this almost by investing in some companies are able to sort of generate their own success. But the idea of being able to somehow predict the future, it strikes me as an incredible belief system that's remarkably overrated.
I couldn't agree with more. I think there are venture capitalists today. We're in this star system of venture capital era now that just by the fact that they've made an investment in a healthcare IT company, for instance, will probably make that company more successful or put them on a different trajectory. And I think we sort of sometimes overvalue that given what the odds of success really are for a startup company.
Right.
Yeah, I'm so with you there. And I'm, you know, and it's, I think this is part and parcel of what's driven valuation sky high. And I wonder at what point things that look like good ideas and were made under the theory that they might be good investments will become bad investments because of valuation when the market won't continue to sustain, you know, the star quality of these things. What do you think? How are we close to the edge of that or are we far from it?
The bubble question.
You know, yeah, I stopped predicting the end is nigh for healthcare IT and digital health is one area a long time ago because it makes no sense to do that. I do think that valuations for entrepreneurs are robust right now in all facets of digital health. And if I'm an entrepreneur, it's a terrific time to be raising capital. And there's all kinds of new investors in this space, from hospital systems to tech funds to regular health, biotech investors who've never done healthcare before. I think that's great for the ecosystem. More money, more innovation, more new ideas, more places to test them. All cycles cycle. And so we will have a down period, just like we had a down period in 2001 for e-health, as we used to call it back then. I don't know when that down period is coming. I don't know what's going to cause it. And I don't know how calamitous it's going to be, but it's definitely going to happen. And part of it to me is like, you know, Lisa and I used to talk about this when we used to see each other. What's the business model and how are you going to generate revenue? That's sort of like my end game question. And I think there's a lot of things that are being funded with the star idea without a business model and a revenue generating and eventually a profit generating motive. And that's it's really hard to do that when you're selling to hospitals, generating sustaining revenue and profit. It's not easy. You know, when your buyer is default going to say no to everything you walk in the door selling them.
I got a call from a Bloomberg reporter yesterday who was writing an article about one of those high-flying health IT, health service startups that had raised, you know, more money than Donald Trump has lost. And, it, you know, and he was saying, you know, this company's losing so much money every month. What do you think about that? And I was like, you know, what I think about it at this moment seems to be irrelevant because it's the business model that's sustaining these companies is the more you can spend, you know, the higher your valuation. It's just amazing to me. It's so not my old school training. And I just really it's so hard though, because if you play the game, the old school game of thinking about profits and revenue, you miss out on a lot of these deals and some of them are gonna be great, you know, some of them are gonna have great returns.
Exactly. That's why I decided I didn't want to play the old school game, and I left the Valley after 7 or 8 years as a general partner at a different fund and started my own. I said, and if I'm going to play an old school private equity game, I joined up with some guys from Carlyle, meaning we invest with companies with profits. Imagine what profits are. I can't play that game in Silicon Valley. First of all, those companies don't exist in the Valley. And second of all, I'm going to be all of a sudden the Luddite in the Valley. Oh, who's this guy investing in profitable companies? Never heard of such a thing. So
yesterday.
Smack dab across the country to do that, and so I don't see any of you guys anymore. But I actually think it's hard to be in the old school way of investing, and be relevant in the Valley these days, for better or for worse.
So, could you give an example of something that you're investing in now, or ideally something that's you know, about the public, or that you've recently invested in, like, or an area that you're particularly excited about? What kind of thing is getting you going these days? Because as you pointed out, you are really a generalist. You're not just a device guy, just a IT guy or a biopharma. You actually seem to move effortlessly and remarkably among all of these spaces. So having have such a broad view of healthcare and having such an affection for it, the way I know you do, what is most exciting you? What do you feel most positive about?
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of stuff, but I mean, one that I'm really honed in on and will be, you know, there'll be an investment announced in shortly is in the behavioral health space. A lot of people are talking about behavioral health. I'm not the only one. Mental health is the center of everything from my perspective. Your physical health is highly correlated to your mental health, as we all know, as a patient. But instead of funding an app or some data algorithm or do any of the other things that have been funded, which I think are terrific and I hope they work, we're actually going to go in and buy a psychiatric hospital and a large outpatient network of outpatient facilities and try to make the change from within. I believe that in healthcare, a lot of the change, the ability to affect the change comes from owning the actual thing that delivers the care. And so we're buying a few hundred beds, large psychiatric inpatient and outpatient provider in a part of the country. And I think that's how you and then we're going to apply telepsych, and then we're going to apply the algorithms that some of these great companies that are being funded in the Valley are doing to those patients. My fundamental view is that you've got to own that service delivery from soup to nuts, and then you can bring in those outside innovations. That's a diametrically opposed to the Valley view. I don't think most Valley venture capitalists today, of which I used to be one, would want to fund a service business that's actually seeing patients in a clinic. Some do, but many don't.
I'm having a total flashback because my first career in healthcare was in the mental health world, and I spent all my time trying to get people out of those psychiatric hospitals where people were going for 30-day stints and people were getting, you know, literally kidnapped off the street and admitted so the hospitals could, you know, get their 30-day reimbursement. So the good news for you, Bijan, is if you get back into that business, there's Uber now, so it's a lot cheaper to get them into the hospital. You can just pick them up, you know.
You know what? UberX the psychiatric facility.
That's crazy. So your family comes from Iran, right? You
lived there for...
Right, and you lived there as a child.
From the time he was 2 to the time he was 7.
I lived there as a kid, yep.
How did you guys end up coming here?
I lived there from
here?
2 to... How did
what
we get
happened?
Out?
Yeah, how did that happen? What was the circumstances that you got out?
The revolution happened, and we had to get out. And my parents made a decision to get us out. We left with basically, you know, a suitcase each, and we got out in 1979. And it was... you know, I don't remember much as a first grader, but you remember some things. And it was the good thing was my parents had lived here in the States before, so it was easy. But you know, you grow up as, imagine moving to the U.S. in 1979 as an Iranian kid, you know, you were instantly pigeonholed as something. And I went to a boys prep school and where everyone played lacrosse other than me. So it sort of forced me to stay inside and study my biology and take computers apart and put them back together. It sort of self-selected me into a certain path. I think that immigrant thing has a lot to do with a lot of people who come to this country as kids from other countries and sort of feel like a little bit of an outcast. You know, my good friend Farzad Mostashari, and my next door neighbor here in D.C., gave his great last talk when he was leaving ONC and happened to be there. He gave this talk about misfits, how we're all, you know, how he felt like a misfit. A lot of people in healthcare IT have felt like misfits. He sort of tied it all together. And, you know, I felt like a misfit growing up sometimes. But I don't mean like I was psychologically harmed, but you feel a little different. And it was great. That's, you know, that made me work harder. I love that. I don't know how to replicate that for my kids because I think they're growing up too cushy these days.
Well, it's funny because Silicon Valley seems to be like, you know, it's like the island of misfit toys out here, right? And this is where you can go with that mentality and that set of feelings and experiences and still succeed.
Yeah, I mean, I love the fact that out here you almost get more props for having gone to math camp than for having been on a lacrosse team. At least that's what I tell myself.
That's a personal thing for you, David, actually.
and that right there, that what David said is the thing I miss the most about the Valley, other than my friends, is that ability for anybody to walk off the street, come to the Valley from any corner of the world, and
nerds,
be judged
nerds
on the
unite,
merits of their intelligence and what they do, rather than where they went to school or who they know.
Oh, come on now. You know they're being judged based on the valuation they get for their company.
That's true. And who's on their board.
Exactly. So have you, while Iran is much in the news, I mean, do you pay attention to that in a special kind of way, or no, it's not part of your life to think about that?
I mean, I pay attention as an avid follower. I haven't been back since 79. I mean, I have this dream at 3 in the morning that I'll go back and be a private equity investor in Iran once it opens up someday, or buy a bunch of old school healthcare businesses like hospitals and dialysis clinics and do that. But no, it's not. That's not a top of mind thing. And you know, hopefully that part of the world gets better. But, you know, it's there's a ton of indigenous medical talent. I mean, U.S. medical schools would send their trainees there to Iran in the 70s. I mean, it's a highly educated English-speaking population, but there's still a lot of political challenges.
So what's next for you? You've got this new fund. You're out there making investments. Are you still excited to be on the investor side? You don't miss the days of the company side, the entrepreneurship?
Working hard.
Oh. First, yeah, working hard. I miss it every day. I miss it every day, Lisa. I miss it every day. And it's never the same when you're a coach versus a player, right?
Right.
And so that's the.
Oh, I'm hang on. I know we're low on time. No, I'm gonna interrupt because I'm so tired of this bullshit. I'm so sick and tired of all these investors, these sort of bullshit patronizing investors who are like, you know, oh, I so miss it. If only I could be like, yeah, you could go, you could be in any business, any start a company anytime you want to. So obviously, you don't miss it so much if you're. You know, you could do that and you're specifically electing to do the other thing. So why don't you respond? Because we've talked about this. So this is a funny conversation. So why don't you respond to that about, oh, I miss it so much, but I'm somehow with a gun to my head being forced to sit in a cushy office and make investments.
Bitter much, David?
But I just find it hypocritical, like that so many investors sort of, you know, like fondly talk. I mean, fondly talk about, oh, how they wish they were out in the field. But then again, but they don't choose to be. So I you know what?
So what is it?
What is it? I don't understand
it. What keeps you on that side of the investor side of the world?
Yeah. How do you resist a temptation that pulls you as much as you're describing? Are you still there?
Bijan appears to have hung up on us.
Okay, maybe he did hang up.
No, of course I didn't hang up. That wasn't that at all.
Hilarious.
No, look, it was about what opportunity was the most compelling when I was leaving. At the time, I was leaving my old firm. If there was a compelling startup, you know, I probably wouldn't have been the one coming up with the idea. But if there's a compelling startup that I wanted with founders I wanted to join, I would have done that. But the compelling founders I met were the guys I started this firm with. And we did all the things a startup does. I mean, heck, we worked out of rental space. We set up the phone lines. I managed all the IT and the benefits. We did everything a startup does. So I feel like I'm back to that entrepreneurial journey. David, you're right. Maybe I'm being two-faced, and I could join some startup if I wanted to. And a few I know, I'm sure I'd love to be at. Maybe I'm getting too old, and I'm just trained to do one thing, and I've forgotten how to twitch the other muscle at this point.
All right. Well, this was an excellent conversation. You're always one of the people who I always love speaking to. I appreciate your comments on Twitter. I wish you would blog more. You used to blog all the time, and now I guess as an investor, you have more constraints. Really, always so great hearing from you, and I'm so glad you were able to join us.
Great to talk to you, Bijan.
Thank you, guys. It was terrific.